I'm John Ostrower, editor-in-chief of The Air Current.
And I'm Brett Snyder, author of Cranky Flyer. You're listening to The Air Show, the podcast where we talk about what goes on in the business of the sky. Now, Brian isn't with us this week, so John, let's talk about parts.
Okay, we're talking about like maintenance, repair, and overhaul parts, spare parts?
No.
No, what kind of parts are we talking about here?
Not those. Calm down. You're getting too excited here.
I get very excited about MRO.
No.
When I have trouble staying awake.
Oh my gosh. Listen.
You know, I'm like, okay, come on, give me MRO. Let's do it.
You have a sickness, sir. We need to do something about this. But no, I am talking about parts 135 and 380.
I see where we're going. Okay. You want to talk about the public charter loophole?
I do. And I do consider it to be a loophole as well. But others will vehemently disagree with you there. It is not a loophole. But we need to explain this to people because we're getting way ahead of ourselves. So you want to start and talk about it?
Okay. So these are parts of the federal code. Specifically, the FARs, or Federal Aviation Regulations, that deal with how people fly and how airlines operate. All the big jets that fly in the U.S. operate under what's called Part 121, United, Southwest, Delta, Alaska. But smaller airplanes are operated under Part 135. It's a scheduled service, but with some big restrictions.
Or some little restrictions. Specifically, it has to be aircraft with 9 seats or less for scheduled service. And also, don't get too excited. There is, I believe, a weight limit. So you can't just do an A380 with 30 seats on it, which maybe not the best business plan anyway. But this rule has been this way since it was sometime in the 90s when the passenger count dropped from what was 30 as the limit. They tried to improve safety and all that and dropped it down to 9. So why does this improve safety and all that? So, John, can you talk about the difference between 121 and 135? And please do not pull out the Code of Federal Regulations. It just may be a summary.
Hold on. I got it right here. It's just... Okay.
Oh, boy.
Open it up. Okay. Let's get into the details here. Okay. So one of the big benefits of a Part 135 operator is that its pilots don't have to have 1,500 hours to achieve an ATP, Air Transport Pilot Certificate, and that allows greater access to pilots. There is less mandatory maintenance and oversight. And the last point, which is probably the most controversial, is that the operations can happen at airports that don't have TSA, and TSA isn't required. So you can operate from a private FBO or wherever. And that's a big point of contention here.
I'm always confused about why it's allowed. And I guess it's just because Part 121 is too much of a burden.
I think to some extent, it's a function of scale, right? You're talking about a smaller aircraft that have a smaller overall operating model here, and the should be some degree of flexibility in terms of cost and operations that go with that. That, I think, is the spirit in which it was created, but that's the whole challenge of the discussion at this point, right?
Right.
So it's the combination of Part 135 and 380 that creates the opportunity here. Take us through that.
Okay, yeah. So look, when the limit dropped to 9 seats from 30 to be able to stay under Part 135, that only applied to scheduled service. So if you're operating a charter, you can still have up to 30 seats. So this creates this opportunity. Here's where the plan was born. So under Part 380, a company can operate a public charter that is scheduled and can be sold. Like on the surface, it looks like you're just buying a ticket on a scheduled airline. But that company then has to charter the airplane from a Part 135 operator. So it looks like a scheduled airline, but it's not. It's just a kind of a brilliant way to use the FARs as a weapon, I guess, this weird loophole.
And so there are two notable airlines that are doing this today, and a third that's trying. We have JSX, which actually used to be known as JetSuite when it first started its operations, and kind of split into two between a private charter small business jet operator and a quasi-regional carrier, which flies, you know, in the semi-private space and goes between FBOs with 30 seats on Embraer 135s and 145s that the airlines have decided that they do not want. JSX does this primarily to have more private experience with less security and all that, and operating out of less congested airports.
Yeah, and when you buy a ticket on JSX, you're actually buying a ticket from JetSuite X Incorporated, and that's the name of the company that arranges for the charter and sells the seats. It then charters the airplane from Deluxe Public Charter LLC, and it's all part of JSX, but it's like the left hand and the right hand and it, whatever. In the end, it satisfies these rules of Part 380, which allows them to fly these 30-seat airplanes with Part 135 rules, and it is completely legal.
And then there's Contour, which flies small routes, usually EAS, Essential Air Services, using the same aircraft, and now CRJ-200s, since SkyWest took a 25% stake in them. It's trying to get around the pilot shortage primarily because it can operate with pilots who have less experience than the law requires. And just a brief kind of sidebar on where that law came from, that was created out of the Colgan air crash, a package of legislation that went into effect in 2013, which said if pilots who do not have 1,500 hours cannot operate 121 aircraft with an air transport pilot certificate. And that created what has widely been perceived as a structural shortage.
Yeah. And let's forget about the fact that those pilots on the Colgan air flight had more than 1,500 hours, and still that didn't save the airplane. But that's a different issue. But what it means is that if you can operate under 135, you can have these pilots that don't have as many hours and aren't able to fly in 121 yet. Or it can go the other direction, because as far as I know, when pilots retire, forced retirement at age 65 at Part 121, they can go back and fly for a 135 operator for longer as well. So you have some very experienced pilots doing this too.
Yeah, I know an American Airlines 777 captain, very senior, that retired and was like, hey, I'm going to go fly for JSX.
Yeah.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
How much of this whole situation is a creation of the fact that the big guys wanted, or more importantly, didn't want to fly to small cities? They were optimizing around big hubs and E-175s, and 50-seat regional jets have fallen out of favor, that they've left enormous amounts of the map uncovered.
Well, I think this certainly enabled this model because it created all these unwanted 50-seat and less airplanes that you could then put 30 seats on, get them for cheap, and fly them around. But the rest of it isn't, I don't think, really a part of that. I mean, it's a lot of these EAS markets that somebody wants to serve. You know, this is where I think the big guys get stuck. And we'll talk about this a little bit later, because on the one hand, I think they like the model for the Contours, and there's SkyWest Charter. You know, SkyWest has had to pull out of so many of these small cities during the pandemic because of the pilot shortage, just couldn't justify doing this. It's trying to come back with SkyWest Charter, which operates under the Contour model as Part 135, and the government just isn't ruling on it. It's just ignoring it, to the point where they actually just sued the government in court saying, guys, you got to let us do this, or at least give us a response. So I think most of the big guys probably don't mind that, right? Because it is, in theory, going to end up feeding their own services. You know, a lot of those SkyWest ones that have gone away were operated under United Express. The problem is that on the other side, you have this JSX model, which at least some of them really do not like. And so it's a matter of weighing the pros and cons and trying to figure out which one is better or worse, and then determine how to fall on that line of if they support it or hate it.
Okay, so I want to talk about both these models and why they're controversial. But first, let's go ahead and take a break.
Hey, John, we have a problem this week.
What's that, Brett?
Well, we need to talk about our sponsor, PlusGrade. And I thought we could talk about all those points buying opportunities that the company offers, but Brian isn't here.
Brian is the king of buying points.
Why don't we talk about SeatBlocker, which allows airlines to sell extra seats to passengers that would otherwise go unsold.
Of course, if a seat is going to go empty, the airline wants to find a way to sell it before the door closes. And selling it to keep it empty for others in the row makes a lot of sense. But I always wondered how airlines would justify that, knowing someone could pay a lot if they just walk up last minute.
Yeah, exactly. And this is why this is so interesting, since it's a soft block. Travelers won't have it confirmed until near departure, when the airline knows it won't be able to actually sell it to a full fare-paying customer. And they aren't even charged until then. So it's a really easy process. It's just, you know, right before time to fly, you might have a very nice surprise.
Remind me who's using this now?
There are nearly 20 airlines using this today, ranging from Aeromexico to Etihad, Qantas, and TAP Air Portugal. But U.S. Airlines, we're still waiting.
PlusGrade are the experts in monetizing unsold inventory. Reach out to them to implement this for your airline so you stop leaving money in empty seats.
I want to talk about a mistake I made several years ago.
You make mistakes?
It happens. You know what they say? Often wrong, never in doubt. It was 2018, and I was doing a question and answer session with some readers. One of them asked me about buy now, pay later programs. They wanted to know if airlines might ever adopt them. I said no. I didn't see this trend coming. Boy, was I wrong. These programs are the ultimate win-win. Travelers can pay for flight installments, and airlines can win revenue they otherwise might have missed.
One company that excels in this business is our sponsor for this episode, Uplift. Uplift is the leading buy now, pay later solution in the travel industry, serving more than 300 of the world's top travel brands. Through personalized, flexible payment options, Uplift helps people get more out of life, one thoughtful purchase at a time. They told us Uplift air vertical bookings are on average 40% higher average value than bookings using other forms of payments. And bookings have 2 times higher ancillary attach rate than non-Uplift bookings. Uplift's enterprise-ready offer engine matches consumers with the right payment plan at the right time, helping brands unlock higher conversion while building customer loyalty. Loans through Uplift offer a complete range of flexible payment solutions on leading travel brand sites throughout the United States and Canada. To learn more, visit www.uplift.com.
And we're back. Let's start with the JSX model. This one has come under fire. Brett, take us through sort of how this works. And more importantly, how do the airlines feel about all this?
Yeah, okay. So how it works, JSX flies out of a lot of different kinds of airports. It flies places where nobody else is, like Scottsdale in Arizona or Boulder in Colorado, but also LAX and Vegas and Love Field, Oakland, you know, big places too. But in all of these places, because it is not a 121 operator, they fly out of FBOs. And so it's like a private experience. You pull up to the FBO, wherever that is at the airport. You need to be there about 15 minutes before your flight, and you hop on. It's a spacious aircraft because they can only put 30 seats on it. And, you know, they'll fly you around and make everything quicker, in theory, for you to go from one place to another. And if we're thinking about this model, there are really two extremes, I guess, on how the airlines feel about it. On the one hand, you have American and Southwest. They hate this. And for them, the easy thing to do is to say it's a safety issue, right? The rules are not as stringent, and it's not fair that they're able to skirt these safety laws, and we're going to have all kinds of doom and gloom coming to us if we continue to allow this to happen. The reality is probably not quite that, though. They're probably just not happy about the fact that JSX is based in in Dallas and has a fair number of flights out of Love Field. They don't want to compete with them. And it is, to be certain, an uneven playing field, I suppose. So, you know, they don't like this. They're fighting it. They're trying to fight it through Washington. You've seen Doug Parker, former CEO of American, actually get involved in this, which is bad news for JSX because he is well connected in Washington. But, you know, trying to find a way to what they say is close a loophole that, to be clear, everything that's being done today is completely legal and there's nothing wrong with what they're doing. It's just American and Southwest and others arguing that the rules should change to get rid of this loophole. Then on the other hand, you have JetBlue, and actually you could put Cotter in this bucket as well. They love these guys. They've invested in them, both of them. It should be noted the founder of JSX, Alex Wilcox, former JetBlue founder. So there's definitely some history between those guys there. But you can even book a JSX flight by in the GDS under a JetBlue code. So they do a code share. So they're all in on that. And then you sort of have the in-between. You have United, which I don't think United has the same amount of love that like a JetBlue has, but it does have a Mileage Plus partnership, so you can earn and burn miles. So they do work together, but it's somewhere in between. But really, it's American and Southwest that are leading the charge on this.
Then we have like the small city model. This one is not about competition. It's about restoring service to all those small cities that lost it during the pandemic. Even though the pilot shortage is easing, the pay rates are so high that it's going to be impossible to compete for EAS, especially when Part 135 carriers flying small airplanes can do the run for so much less. If airports want bigger jets, it's going to be very costly subsidy from the feds. That's going to be hard to justify.
Yeah, and this, as we talked about earlier, this is a totally different argument than the JSX one. But if you're the big guys, if you're American or Southwest, you can't differentiate. You have to pick one because they're arguing that this is a safety issue. So you can't say, well, it's only a safety issue if it competes with me. and it's fine if it's going to help me with small cities or something. So American and Southwest have looked at it and said, all right, we need to come out against this. Others, I think, are sitting back a little bit and trying to figure it out. But it's definitely hard to thread that needle. So they just have to pick one side or the other.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the reason they've made the safety debate as the core of their argument is fundamentally that's the thing that will, you know, get the hair on the back of people's necks standing up.
Oh, for sure. We've seen that.
It's a visceral argument. Oh, completely, completely. But I think it's also really important to note, and I think this is a factual statement, that the airlines in the U.S., the big airlines in the U.S., use their power to prevent competition and new entrants. It's just like, of course, everyone protects their turf.
What?
What?
This is new to me.
The scandal.
I have not heard this before.
You know, there's so much history around sort of new entrants popping up in various places. It's like, hey, we can have a better experience than the big airlines. And the big airlines go, no, you will not pass, right? And so, I mean, we see this over and over again. Remember Legend?
I do.
In Texas, right?
So for those who don't remember Legend, this was an actually pretty brilliant plan as well, that Love Field had a rule that I think it was 50 seats. It was somewhere around there. If you flew an aircraft with more than 50 seats, then you were hamstrung by the Wright Amendment and could only fly to neighboring states or within Texas. But if you had less than 50 seats, you could go anywhere. And so they outfitted an old, I think they went DC-9, right? Had less than 50 seats and they flew to LA and wherever else in like a business style configuration. And it was a pretty great idea, but then, there was murder from American.
Yeah. Well, those who were involved with that will like tell you the stories of like what American did to Legend to effectively sit on their prospects for survival. So the airlines have an immunity response triggered here. They will scream about the purity of the free market, and then they'll scream about, you know, under regulation in certain areas. The airlines want to have their cake and eat it too. Brett, where do you fall here?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we can tie in some other rules here too. I'm not a fan of the 1500 hour rule. And to me, that leads into this, because the 1500 hour rule, the idea that if you get to 1500 hours, you're going to be a better pilot than someone that's down at 350 or whatever it might be. It's just not necessarily the case. There's quality of time. There's a lot that goes into that, right?
And quality of training.
Training, yeah. And just general experience. I mean, if you did 1500 hours flying long haul, you're not getting nearly what you're getting if you're flying, you know, in the Northeast on a turboprop or something like that. I mean, it's all very different experiences. So, you know, seeing that and then saying, okay, this particular rule has lesser pilot regulations, I don't really have an issue with that piece of it so much, because I think there are very good pilots, if you have the right kind of training at this level, that there's nothing wrong with that, and there's no safety issue on that. What I don't know is much about what the different maintenance, oversight, all those types of requirements, if there's anything there that's particularly concerning. I doubt there is, but maybe.
So just the other day, we had a JSX Embraer 145 had a main landing gear collapse when landing at Houston. And so that's only going to accelerate the debate here even more. And so certainly the airlines or the big airlines are going to go, well, look at that. You know, I think obviously we're watching and waiting for information from the NTSB, which is investigating, to actually come up with a preliminary report and kind of understand what's going on here. But certainly the big guys are going to use this as fuel, and guaranteed.
Well, sure. But United is saying this as its tire bounces down the runway at SFO. I mean, there are plenty of examples of the big guys having landing gear failures or whatever it may be. So, you know, let's not jump to conclusions here. Obviously, far fewer operations that are going under 135 at JSX than you have from the big guys. So from a percentage standpoint, maybe it turns out that way. But we haven't seen an incident. I think if we're talking about how the government reacts, we probably wouldn't see any real movement unless there actually is a fatal accident or something really hugely concerning. I can hear the NTSB yelling into the void right now saying, why? But that seems to be how we rule here.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of really interesting things going on here. Number one, JSX has also ordered a metric ton of future electric airplanes. Mm-hmm. And they've committed to buying it. So they put their stake in the ground and said, hey, we're going to be doing this. We believe in the future of regional air mobility. So it's sort of spent a lot of time talking about eVTOLs, like this regional side of it in terms of how new entrants get traction. There's a huge debate going on right now about whether or not that's even viable. And so there's also a fair question, I think, to ask within these companies as they operate today, is what is that growth plan? And how do you expand from where you are? And is there a natural ceiling to where they exist? I mean, Brett, is this business model have distinct limits to it, or are we going to see this become more of a, you know, fill in the gaps in between the dots on the route map?
Well, it may have distinct limits, profitability being one of them. We don't really know. I mean, they've already had to go back to the well before, but they've been going pretty fast right now in growing the network. But I'm not sure, you know, when you look at this and you think of the costs that are involved, it has to be something where there's premium demand, because the fares have to be higher than a traditional airline. You can't have a Spirit or somebody else competing and them saying, hey, we can match those costs. I mean, that's just not going to happen. So I think, you know, from that perspective, it will naturally limit the number of markets that might make sense. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a lot more growth possibility out there. But for me, if we're still talking about the safety issue, though, this is where I struggle. I mean, American Airlines has an interline with Southern Airways Express, right? Flying 9-seaters all over the place under regular Part 135. So is it not unsafe because there are only 9 people there, but if you had 10 people, it would suddenly be unsafe? Or, you know, how do you even come to rationalizing this argument when it comes to safety? It's either it's unsafe and this practice has to stop completely, or it is safe. I mean, I guess there could be an in-between, which is we need to just tighten up some of the rules on the 135 side and then it'll be okay. But it just feels really hard to make these arguments the way that they're doing it. And I don't know how to rationalize that.
It's possible it's not meant to be rationalized. I mean, it's possible they're cherry picking here. And fundamentally, that will probably end up hurting their broader argument because, like, these services are pretty popular.
To some extent, we don't really know a lot of details about it. You know, it'll be popular until it's not, I guess, until they go out of business. But it is.
Well, stepping back here, I think what the existence of a JSX or a Contour are sort of indicative of is sort of like you've got these things happening where a government sets policy or a government sets up TSA, and TSA is onerous and it ends up totally wrecking the airport experience, or totally and you have a 1500 hour rule, which makes it really hard to find pilots, and you have loss of service. And so these other carriers step into the void. So it's like you see these creations of government policy that take place. I find that absolutely fascinating, because what effectively you have is like a, you know, someone who's just following the policy changes as they go to try and create an experience where, you know, well-heeled flyers in Silicon Valley or Southern California want to go out and you know, not have to deal with TSA or not have to deal with the crowds or the lines and so you see the it's kind of a microcosm for the overall competitive dynamics within the industry. Who can go places that others can't? Who can give an experience that others can't? Who can afford to do that? And can those businesses even survive, even if that's the case? So, Brett, one to watch?
Yeah, I mean, this is really the question is, who has the most power in this political struggle? You know, the key arguments are almost just outside of the real issue here, which is just, you know, who's going to win the battle? And it's deepest pockets, best relationships, whatever it may be. And I guess we'll have to stay tuned and see.
You've been listening to The Air Show. If you have suggestions or questions for us, or interested in sponsoring the podcast, go to our website, theairshowpodcast.com, to get in touch.
Thanks to PlusGrade and Uplift for sponsoring the show. The Air Show podcast is produced and edited by Sarah Fay. Our theme music is by Joshua Mosier. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.